Not a week goes by without some mention of homeless people in the news in our region. The concerns vary, from making sure people do not freeze to death on cold nights to making sure homeless people do not block sidewalks in downtown areas. The solutions proposed vary as well. The state of Utah gets credit for reducing the population of people living on the streets. And a man central to that effort visits Redding later this week to explain the process. Lloyd Pendleton was the director of the Utah Homeless Task Force. He'll be speaking in Redding Thursday at noon at Sequoia Middle School, brought in by the Women's Fund of Shasta Regional Community Foundation. Lloyd Pendleton, thanks for joining us here on the Jefferson Exchange today.
Thanks for the opportunity, Jeff.
I understand you retired from the LDS Church on a Friday 10 years ago and went to work for the state the following Monday. Why get back into things so fast?
Well, I'm committed to this, and I had some conferences I need to be going to that following week, and so I said I might as well go to work and have them pay for going to the conference. And so I just, it was a weekend retirement.
Had you done anything with dealing with homeless populations before?
I had. I had been loaned out by the LDS Church to the homeless shelter in 1993, and I spent a year on site helping turn that around, and that got me exposed to the nonprofit and homeless world. And following that, then I got involved in several committees and boards. So from 93 up into 2003, I was engaged in that process and became familiar with it. And so when the state started to put together the 10-year plan, they asked that I be loaned out on a part-time basis to the state to lead the effort on putting together the 10-year plan and to implement it. And so for 3 years, I worked as a part-time loaned executive in putting this together. So when I retired in 2006, and the state offered me a job to finish implementing this statewide.
So it's just the continuation of work, just with a different office.
Right.
Okay. When we talk about the 10-year plans, I want to make sure that people understand we're not talking about something unique to Utah. I mean, homeless 10-year plans or 10-year plans to end homelessness exist in all states, don't they, or should by federal?
Correct.
Yeah.
The federal government has started the process back in 2002, 2003 under the Bush administration, because they had learned through some pretty significant research that 10% of the homeless population was classified as chronically homeless or long-term homeless, more the stereotypical homeless person, mental health, substance abuse issues, primarily men, and fairly visible. And they learned also, being only 10%, but they also cost the community $20,000 to $45,000 a year per person in emergency services, emergency room visits, EMT runs, jail, police interactions, etc. So the federal government put forth this effort and says, let's do a 10-year plan and get these chronically homeless people into housing using the Housing First model that had been developed in New York City. So there was about, I've read where reports say over 400 10-year plans were prepared in 2003, 4, and 5, and 6 across the country. So Utah was not unique in the 10-year planning process.
I wonder if Utah is a somewhat different place to address homelessness, given the prevalence of members of the LDS Church and the importance within the LDS Church of caring for family.
I think it probably had an impact, although the church did not take the lead. They loaned me out, and they're very supportive of the process. But I would agree there's a culture of caring for those that are in need, and the church, LDS Church, has this pretty extensive welfare system, which I worked in the welfare department for the LDS Church for 26 years. And so there is that propensity. And so that was tapped into among the political leaders and community leaders and service providers. But I don't think it's so unique that this cannot be done, or this can be done in other locations.
No, I was trying to get a sense for just what the general situation was. So let's talk about the general situation, the numbers of homeless people in Utah 10 years ago when you set out on this working for the state.
Well, on any given night, there's around 3,000 individuals that will be homeless. In 2005, when was our baseline, there was a high percentage that were not sheltered. By 2015, our chronic homeless numbers were down 91%. Our homeless veterans were basically housed or sheltered by the end of 2015. But our overall numbers have not changed. I mean, our veterans and chronic homeless are down. But because of the recession, and we've had a huge increase in family homelessness, and so our total numbers were still about 3,000 that are homeless. And so the state now is putting together a plan for 2020 for homeless families and homeless youth.
Lloyd Pendleton is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's the former director of the Utah Homeless Task Force. He'll be speaking in Redding on Thursday about this, about his work in Utah. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange. Questions and comments on topic, welcome at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, two letters, jx@jeffnet.org. So one of the first moves then, I mean, when you're trying to implement a Housing First program, I imagine one of the first moves is lining up political support.
Yes, that was an important part of it. The governor's office was supportive of this. As a matter of fact, the governor had signed a letter asking that I be loaned out from the LDS Church. So she was supportive of this process. And as we began, we made changes in the structure of the committees, and she supported that, so that we had the lieutenant governor chair our state homeless coordinating committee. We're on our fourth lieutenant governor, and all of them have been chairing and been actively involved, and that becomes important. And then going around, and this is a statewide effort, this 91% reduction is statewide, not just Salt Lake City. And so getting the political leaders to buy in, and it took time to educate them and to help them catch the vision of how this could be done. And as we got Housing First or Permanent Supportive Housing built, then we'd have them come and take a tour so they could see what we meant when we said putting chronically homeless people into housing. And so it was part of the process of getting that engagement and the homeless service providers to come together. So mayors, county commissioners, lieutenant governor, all part of the process.
And so where did you look to study Housing First? You mentioned New York City. I've heard of it starting in Seattle as well. I guess it doesn't matter where it started so much as where it's effective. And are there a number of communities from which to draw experience?
Yes, there's a lot of communities are using the Housing First model. That was promoted by HUD and their conferences, and so they've done a lot of research, continue to do research on the effectiveness of Housing First. And the concept of Housing First is that you take a person right off the street who's been homeless 20 years and you put them right into housing. You don't put them in the shelter, or you can take them out of the shelter also, but you don't get them housing ready. You take them as they are and you put them into housing. Then you wrap services around them with the case management. And you help them stabilize in that housing. As they begin to stabilize, then they're able to deal with underlying issues of mental health, substance abuse. Because if you don't have a house, a place that you're safe and you're secure and your stuff is not stolen, it's very difficult to deal with medical issues and mental health issues and substance abuse issues. So that's the model. And when we heard about it, we said, will that work in Salt Lake City? Will that work in Utah? You know, that's New York. So we did part of this process, we created pilots. So low cost, low risk, high return in the way of learning experience. And so we created a pilot of 17 that we put into scattered site while we build a 100-unit single site facility. And 22 months later, all 17 of those individuals were housed. And we took the most challenging ones we could find because we wanted to learn the most. So we became believers that the Housing First model worked in Salt Lake City as well as in New York City.
You described it as taking on a low-risk approach. How could you limit the risk?
Well, we only had 17.
Okay.
Rather than 150. So we said we read the research. We said it makes sense, and we're committed to it. So while we build 100 units, you know, if we put 100 there and then had to deal with 100 right at once and learn, we said, let's practice on, work with 20 and end up being 17 and see what works, what doesn't work. And so we can learn from that. So when we have 100 in our first unit, then we'll know what to do. So, and it was $150,000, small amount of money investment, but we learned a huge amount from that and we became believers. And then we went forth and built 1,200 units and several hundred scattered sites in order to get our individuals who are chronically homeless into housing.
So did the $150,000 build 20 units?
No, it didn't build. We did scattered site.
Oh, scattered. Okay. So you just bought spaces that existed?
So we went to landlords and says, we want to rent to you a chronically homeless person who's mentally ill and has substance abuse.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, okay, we will master lease. We'll pay the rent. We will repair any damage that they may do, and here's a number you can call 24/7 if there's any issues. So we mitigated their concerns and got the landlords to allow us to rent to them, and we only had to move one person, I think, to another facility, to another landlord, because they kept bringing a lot of the friends in.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a great learning experience, and we could start within, when we had Samson Bears come out and talk to us in June, By August, we had 5 people housed, and by September, 17 housed. So we quickly launched the idea that we had become aware of and been trained in to learn.
And who's Sam Sabaris, who you just mentioned?
Dr. Sam Sabaris is the man who's created the Housing First model in New York City about 22 or 3 years ago. Seattle was using that model also about the same time, but Sam's kind of been the one that's been given credit for the Housing First approach.
Housing First, as implemented by Lloyd Pendleton and a crew of people in the state of Utah. He's sharing his experience with us here now, and he'll talk about it on Thursday at noon, brought into Reading by the Women's Fund of the Shasta Regional Community Foundation. You can join the conversation here on the Jefferson Exchange at this moment, 800-838-3760 over the phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. I understand, Lloyd, that your own ideas about homelessness had evolved quite a bit over time.
Well, yes, I was reared on a small ranch in the west desert of Utah, and as I would go into Salt Lake and see those hobos, as we called them back in the 1950s, I would say, get a job, you lazy bums, because, you know, when you're reared on a ranch, you learn to work. I mean, that's what you do is work. So I expected everybody had that same capacity. So over the years, as I became more aware of the circumstances, when I spent a year at the homeless shelter there in Salt Lake City helping turn the organization around, I met a lot of homeless people, got to know them personally, and began to see them as human beings that had had tremendous abuse in their childhood, mental health issues. And so my own personal perspective changed to realize it wasn't mine to condemn and judge them. It was mine to bring hope, because I'd been blessed with good health and with energy and capacity to organize things. So I shifted to where, all right, you know, And I believe, you know, that God sees them as his children, and they're my brothers and sisters. And so, therefore, it's important for me to reach out and to provide hope. And there's accountability as well, because when we put them into housing, they pay rent. We don't give them free housing, as many reporters will report. There's accountability, and they can be evicted for not paying rent. So, but they need an opportunity where they can go and get stable and change their life to the level they're able to.
Still a fair number of people who feel like you once felt, though. Just yesterday, I was reading a letter to the editor that said, we got to stop giving things to homeless people because they'll just keep asking for them and not going out and finding their own stuff.
Sure. Mm-hmm. And I had that same attitude many years ago. Now I realize they need an opportunity for hope, and housing is a key piece of stabilizing that. But at the same time, they still need to be responsible to do what they can do. So they pay 30% of their income or $50, whichever is greater. So there's incentive for them to go and to get income in order to pay their rent. And once they get stable, then their alcohol, drug consumption goes down significantly. They're able to get stabilized, and then about 10% a year will move out successfully into other housing.
So what you're talking about is transitioning people from survival mode to actually living.
Correct. But on the street, you're surviving. And you're at a high level of anxiety, you get beaten up. Homeless people get victimized a lot. A lot of the normal, you know, regular citizens see that homeless people are victimizing them. Well, they're just trying to survive. They may panhandle, maybe a little aggressive, but they're trying to survive and get something to eat. And yes, there are those few that are supporting the drug habit, and I don't give to those. If somebody's panhandling me and I sense they're homeless, they want some food, I'll say, come on in and I'll buy you a sandwich and let's visit for a while. So the visit, the opportunity to interact with them, I think is important or more important than just giving them a dollar or two.
What were some of the common threads you found in that year you spent at the shelter, getting to know people as human beings? I mean, what are often the things that are common to each one of the people that you talk to?
They've lost hope. They don't know how to navigate the system. They've been victimized, and so it's easy for a case manager to say, go over here to the workforce services or employment center and to go over here and to go over there and do all this agency work. They go over there. They may not have graduated from high school. They may have a third grade reading level. They don't know how to read all these forms, and so they don't go, or if they do go, they don't understand what they've been told to do or asked to do, so they're frustrated. So they need that kind of support to go over, and here's how you negotiate. Here's how you fill out the form. They need that kind of basic support that we expect everybody has, and they don't have that capacity.
So, Lloyd, then, is the housing first model somewhat labor intensive, at least when people are first in it? Because when you talk about wrapping services around people in addition to the shelter itself, you need to have people checking up on them fairly often, it sounds
like.
Well,
right. I mean, the worst thing somebody could, a community could do is to build a permanent supportive housing and put 100 chronic homeless people in there and not give them any kind of case management support. It'd be a disaster. They don't know how to navigate and negotiate the system. They don't know how to take care of their room. Sometimes you need to teach them how to clean. If you've been on the street for 20 years, living in camps and living in shelters, we had one case manager, and then one of our pilots, there was in our pilot, they came in and said, man, this place is cold. Why don't you turn up the heat? He said, turn up the heat? How do you do that? You see this thing on the wall, it's called a thermostat, and you just move this lever. They've been on the street for 20 years. They didn't know about a thermostat. They didn't know how to navigate those basic skills. So it's a different level of engagement and process. And yes, it's expensive, but it's less expensive than leaving them on the street, going to the emergency room, and going to jail, and interacting with the police, all those kinds. Those are being paid for by the community already. It's more humane and more economical to put them into housing with case management support.
So is the state of Utah actually seeing savings within any government accounts, or is just less money being spent in the social services system spread across public-private?
It's spread across the public-private. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can analytically say here, I mean, we take 100 people and you put them into housing. Their time in the jail goes down significantly. Their time in the emergency room goes down significantly. But there's still a large demand out there. And so to say, now we're going to go take money away from the sheriff, take money away from the police department. That hasn't been done, and that will be a long time before that would be done.
Mm-hmm. We're talking to Lloyd Pendleton, the former director of the Utah Homeless Task Force, appearing in Reading this week, Thursday at noon at Sequoia Middle School. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. Here's Rick and Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hello, good morning.
Hi.
Hi. I'd like to ask, a moment ago your guest said that there's some accountability. The example he gave was that when homeless people are moved into housing, they're required to pay rent. My question is, how can a homeless person who can't even find enough food to eat suddenly be expected to come up with rent money? Where do they get the money?
Okay, good question. Thanks for that, Rick. Appreciate it. Lloyd?
All right, Rick. When they get into housing, they have a disabling condition, so we work with them to get them disability insurance for which they're eligible, or general assistance. The state of Utah has a general assistance fund. We also work with them to get them into employment if they're stable and able to do that. And we will scholarship them for the first month or two because we realize they don't have that income. Some of them have veterans pensions that we can get them access to. So you work with them to say, what are they eligible for, and then help them work through that whole process of filling out the forms.
So you do find a lot of them are eligible for some sort of income that,
right.
that they weren't aware of or just weren't accessing?
Right. They weren't aware of. They didn't have an address. They may have applied, but then they couldn't be found. And so there's now that they have an address, a permanent address, then you can begin to start to deal with those social services that were meant for this particular group of people, have mental health issues, substance abuse, disabling conditions. And so you work with them very diligently in order to help them get access to those. And then you link them up at the food pantry. And the LDS Church has their Bishop Storehouse, which then you can access that, help them access that, work with other churches who will bring in those kinds of support. So you help them begin to link into those services that are available to them and for which they're eligible.
So for a community like Reading or Eugene or Ashland, all communities that are dealing with homeless populations, this can seem like a big problem with no easy solutions. I mean, how do you recommend any community starting?
Oh, well, I think the way we did it was an effective way. The first thing is needed is some champions, some political leaders who say, yes, this is a high priority. We're going to make this something we're going to do. It's going to impact our community positively. So finding the champions who are willing to do that and repurpose existing resources. No community I'm aware of is going to go out and get $10 million to do just this. You're going to have to take existing resources and repurpose them. That's what we did. And and then you start small. You say, well, I don't know. We need to take a look at this. So do a pilot. I was in another community in Washington 2 or 3 months ago and suggested that I was there in November, and I suggested you get 5 chronically homeless people housed by February 1. And then they committed to do 20 by June. Well, February 1, they called me the mayor and the staff and says, we have five of them identified, we're putting them into housing. And they reported on the energy that was created by just putting out there, we're going to get these five high users of the public service system, the jail, we're going to get them into housing. And the community started to rally around just even those five. So they reported the energy that really became exciting, that something positive was being done. And in the process, they came across land that they was available. They started to create this new vision. So when you have that vision, you begin to see opportunities of how you can get housing for these folks. So starting with a pilot fairly quickly with some champions really changes the dynamics of the discussion.
And then you mentioned that, that the reduction in Utah has been about 91%.
Yes.
So obviously still some people on the streets. What's the hardest part about getting to that last group out there? What's the issue that stops them from getting into
groups? Most of us think, well, why wouldn't people want housing? Well, if you have a severe mental health situation, you go into four walls, and you've been on the street for 25 years, and you go into four walls, or you're by yourself, etc. There's a culture on the street that kind of supports you, even though it's a little maybe dysfunctional, but it's still a culture that supports you. So there's a lot of them that don't want to go into housing. They feel they're claustrophobic or whatever. So we know that there will be some who probably never will come into housing, but as a community, we've committed to give them a housing opportunity or opportunities. We'll continue to outreach to them, but it's still their choice. And a lot of them, as they see their friends go into housing and they go visit them, many of them will start to say, okay, I'm willing to do that. So there'll be so as a community, we can say we can offer housing to everybody, and we're tracking that. So we've done what we can do, and we know there'll be a functional zero, and we don't know what that percentage is, but there will be some, and there will be some who will die on the street. Because we had 92 homeless or formerly homeless people die last year, and the average age is 51. But about 60% of those died in firm supportive housing now.
Okay, so a difference certainly from years before when the whole process
of housing years first. Before, the average age was 46.
Okay, so definitely moved the numbers in a lot of positive directions. Lloyd Pendleton is the former director at the Utah Homeless Task Force. Again, Reading Thursday at noon at Sequoia Middle School, brought in by the Women's Fund of the Shasta Regional Community Foundation. Lloyd, thanks for joining us on The Exchange today.
Thank you for the opportunity.
All right, take care.